This morning we're going to do a little half-hour look at the assassinations in Lebanon, which have been widely blamed on Syria. So back in February, actually on Valentine's Day, as it were, Rafik Hariri was killed by a car bomb in Beirut, along with about 22 other people. It was a huge bomb. And he was a former prime minister of Lebanon, supposedly sort of an enemy of Syria. And right away, fingers were pointed at Syria. The Washington Post of February 16th said, "The despicable murder of Mr. Hariri benefits no one outside the rogue regime in Damascus, and the world should respond accordingly." Well, this is really kind of absurd, because Syria has known nothing but trouble ever since. It was forced to remove its troops from Lebanon, and anti-Syrian politicians were elected in Lebanon, along with the Syrian politicians from Syria's ally Hezbollah. So Syria did not benefit. In fact, they've been on the defensive ever since. And it's really, if anyone benefited, it was probably Israel and the warlords of Washington. And let's get to a little rundown from the World Socialist website. According to them, Tel Aviv calculates that the expulsion of Syria from Lebanon, or the toppling of the Ba'athist regime in Damascus, could bring to power a Lebanese government more amenable to Israeli demands. In particular, both want Lebanon to grant citizenship to the estimated 400,000 Palestinian refugees inside that country, a move that would effectively abrogate their right, never recognized by Israel, to return to the homes from which they were expelled in the course of the creation and expansion of the Zionist state. So that's one of the things that Libya wanted to gain by the weakening of the Syrian government. Another comment comes from Patrick Seal, who is a he's an author who's written several books about the Middle East. And this is what he had to say. This is from an article in the UK Guardian of February 23rd. This is Patrick Seal. "If Syria killed Rafik Hariri, Lebanon's former prime minister and mastermind of its revival after the civil war, it must be judged an act of political suicide. Syria is already under great international pressure from the U.S., France, and Israel. To kill Hariri at this critical moment would be to destroy Syria's reputation once and for all and hand its enemies a weapon with which to deliver the blow that could finally destabilize the Damascus regime and even possibly bring it down. So attributing responsibility for the murder to Syria is implausible. The murder is more likely to be the work of one of its many enemies. This is not to deny that Syria has made grave mistakes in Lebanon. Its military intelligence apparatus has interfered far too much in Lebanese affairs." Patrick Seal goes on to say, "Hariri was not a diehard enemy of Syria. For 10 of the past 12 years, he served as Lebanon's prime minister under Syria's aegis. A few days before his murder on February 14th, he held a meeting with Syria's deputy foreign minister, Walid Mualim. They were reported to have discussed a forthcoming visit by Hariri to Damascus. Hariri had not officially joined the opposition in Lebanon, but was thought to be attempting to mediate between Syria and the opposition. If Syria did not kill Hariri, who could have? There is no shortage of potential candidates, including far-right Christians anxious to arouse opinion against Syria and expel it from Lebanon, which eventually happened, Islamist extremists who have not forgiven Syria for its repression of the Muslim Brotherhood in the 80s, and, of course, Israel. Israel's ambition has long been to weaken Syria, sever its strategic alliance with Iran, and destroy Hezbollah. Israel has great experience at, quote, targeted assassinations, not only in the Palestinian territories, but across the Middle East. Over the years, it has sent hit teams to kill opponents in Beirut, Tunis, Malta, Amman, and Damascus. Syria, Hezbollah, and Iran have stood up against U.S. and Israeli hegemony over the region. Syria continues to demand that Israel return the Golan Heights, seized in 1967. Damascus will not allow Lebanon to conclude a separate peace with Israel unless its own claim is also addressed. Hezbollah, in turn, is possibly the only Arab force to have inflicted a defeat on Israel. Its guerrillas forced Israel out of South Lebanon after a 22-year occupation. Hezbollah continues to be a big irritant to Israel because it has acquired a deterrent capability. Israel can no longer attack Lebanon with impunity, as it did for decades, without risking a riposte from Hezbollah rockets. So that is Patrick Seal writing on the who benefit, who stands to gain, who stands to lose by these assassinations and the ensuing turmoil. Well, what happened after the assassination and the change of government in Lebanon, the UN commissioned an investigation by a German judge, Detlev Meles. And he investigated and came up with a 54-page report in which he seemed to, he pointed the finger at Syria or Syrian intelligence operatives. He didn't quite blame the government of Bashar al-Assad, but the Western media kind of strongly implied that he did. And his report came out, after several months of investigation, and it had its critics. One of the critics of the report was Robert Parry, who is a longtime investigative journalist, used to write for Newsweek, and he did a lot of writing on the Iran-Contra scandal back in the 80s. And this is what Robert Parry has to say. A new United Nations report implicates the Syrian government in the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, giving a lift to George W. Bush's demand for regime change in Damascus. But the investigation has many holes, including failure to follow up on a mysterious van connected to the February 14th bombing. The way the bombing happened was that this van drove up alongside Hariri's car, and apparently a suicide bomber driving that van exploded the bomb and killed Hariri and the other people. That's back to Robert Parry. The 54-page UN report concludes that the bomb that killed Hariri and 22 other people in Beirut was likely a white Mitsubishi Canter van that closed in on the convoy of cars carrying Hariri and his entourage before a suicide bomber detonated the powerful blast. While the identity of the bomber remains a mystery, a Japanese forensic team matched 44 of 69 pieces of the van's wreckage to Canter parts manufactured by Mitsubishi Fuso Corporation, and even identified the specific vehicle. The chain of possession for that van thus would seem to be a crucial lead in identifying the killers. But on that central point, the UN investigation made little headway, devoting only a few paragraphs to how the van ended up in Beirut. On page 42, the UN report states that the Japanese forensic team reported that the van was traced back to Sagamihara City, Japan, where on October 12, 2004, it was stolen. The report contains no details about the Japanese investigation of the theft, nor does it indicate what Japanese police may have discovered about the identity of the thieves or how they may have shipped the van from a suburb of Tokyo to the Middle East in the 4 months before the Hariri attack. Instead, the UN investigation concentrated on far flimsier and more circumstantial pieces of evidence, such as phone records showing communications between various security officials near the route of Hariri's trip. In reaching its tentative conclusions fingering Syria, the UN probe also relies heavily on two witnesses of uncertain credibility who implicated Syrian security officials, although with accounts that are partially contradictory. For instance, the two supposed witnesses differed on the fate of the Lebanese youth Ahmad Abu Adas, who claimed responsibility for the suicide bombing in a videotape released to Al Jazeera television after the Hariri assassination. According to that video, Hariri was slain by Islamic militants because of his work as, quote, the agent of the infidels, and Abu Adas identified himself as a suicide bomber. But the UN report used the supposed witnesses to dismiss the videotape as part of a disinformation campaign to deflect suspicion from Syria. One witness, described in the UN report as of Syrian origin but resident in Lebanon, who claims to have worked for the Syrian intelligence services in Lebanon, said Abu Adas played no role in the crime except as a decoy, who was detained in Syria and forced at gunpoint to record the videotape before being killed. Another witness, Zuhir ibn Muhammad Said Sadiq, claimed he saw Abu Adas at a camp in Zabadani, Syria, where Sadiq said the Mitsubishi van was filled with explosives. Sadiq said Abu Adas planned to carry out the assassination, but changed his mind and was then killed by Syrians who put his body in the vehicle carrying the bomb. One of the problems with such witnesses is that they can be unreliable for a variety of reasons, including the possibility they are paid or otherwise induced to present false stories to help achieve a result favored by powerful political figures or countries. Similar questions are already being raised about the key Hariri case witness Sadiq. Der Spiegel, the German news magazine, reported that Sadiq is a convicted swindler who was caught in lies by the UN investigative team. Der Spiegel also reported that the intermediary for Sadiq's testimony was Syrian dissident Rifat al-Assad, who opposes the regime of his nephew, President Bashar Assad, and that Sadiq apparently was paid for supplying his testimony. Sadiq called his brother from Paris in late summer and declared, quote, I've become a millionaire, the brother said, according to Der Spiegel. In the Hariri case, the chief UN investigator, German prosecutor Detlef Melis, found himself under intense international pressure that some observers compared to the demands on UN weapons inspector Hans Blix in early 2003. If you remember that, Hans Blix was investigating weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and he kept saying that that there was no evidence of them, and he was roundly denounced by the Bush administration. He was also denounced by Richard Butler, who was a UN investigator on that issue, who was sort of trumpeting the same claims that turned out to be false, namely that Iraq had a lot of weapons of mass destruction. So the fact that a person is working for the UN may or may not give him extra credit. Well, anyway, that was Robert Parry talking. Here is another article from San Francisco Indie Media, and it's from a group called Social Democracy Now. And I don't have the name of the author of this, But it's being put out by Social Democracy Now, and this is from Saturday, October 22, 2005. And you can find it if you go to the San Francisco Indie Media website, which is sf.indiemedia.org. This is what Social Democracy Now has to say. The Malish report on the Hariri assassination is just another dodgy dossier. In order to lay the blame for the assassination at Syria's door, it specializes in innuendo and unverified allegations by anonymous persons. The only named individual purporting to possess information incriminating Syria turns out to be a multiply convicted swindler who is paid handsomely for his revelations by a Syrian dissident. The Social Democracy Now! Report says that there are four pieces of information which supposedly incriminate Syria. And the first is the existence of tension between Hariri and senior Syrian officials, including Syrian President Bashar Assad, over the extension of President Emil Lahoud's term. He was the president of Lebanon, which allegedly culminated at a meeting held on August 26, 2004. And Indy Media says there's nothing inherently suspicious about strong disagreement between Hariri and the Syrians over the extension of Lahoud's term. According to Hariri himself, in a conversation recorded on February 1, 2005, he was extremely disturbed when he learned during a 15-minute meeting with President Assad that Assad planned to extend Lahoud's term. However, the fragment of the conversation included in the Malish report implies that Hariri had no actual say in the decision. The only incriminating aspect of the murder is a claim made on June 22, 2005 by anti-Syrian Beirut newspaper editor Gibran Twaini that Hariri had told him that Assad had said that if he voted against Lahoud's extension, he would blow him up, unquote. However, this remark seems ex post facto, and no other individual cited in the report, including Hariri's son Saad, mentions Assad threatening to blow him up. What's more, on September 3, 2004, the Hariri bloc approved of Lahoud's extension. So with that in mind, we will go on to this other assassination of that newspaper editor, Gibran Twaini, who was killed by a roadside bomb a few weeks ago on December 12th. He was the Beirut editor who claimed that Hariri told him that Bashar al-Assad had threatened to blow him up. Robert Fisk was interviewed on December 14th on Democracy Now! Some of you may have heard that interview. And he... Actually, Fisk seems to, who has lived in Lebanon for a long, long time, I think 30 years, he's lived in Beirut and covered the Middle East. And he seems to be not quite convinced, but he seems to go along with the great suspicion of Syria in the assassination of Hariri. But he talks about the December assassination of Gibran Twaini. It happened on Fisk in his interview, in an almost word-perfect type car bombing on a mountain hillside in Mokalas. I went to the scene very shortly afterwards. There were bits of him and other people all over the road, a narrow mountain road that he would not have told anyone but his closest compatriots that he was traveling on, a road he regarded as secure. There was a car bomb waiting for him at a corner of the road that blew his own vehicle clean through the railings and down a ravine among palm trees and pine trees where it was burning when I arrived. So clearly an expert, a political killing, almost certainly what we call a line of sight killing. In other words, a murderer must have been hiding on the roof or in the upper floors of a building in the surrounding area, close enough to see in a moment when his car passed to press the button and far enough away not to be killed by flying glass or wounded by concrete blasting in. His death is universally attributed in Lebanon to the Syrians, or at least, let us say, to the Syrian intelligence service of the Ba'ath Party in Damascus, not necessarily to the president himself, Bashar al-Assad. Now, the interesting thing there is that, according to Fisk, one of Twaney's circle of friends must have tipped off this bomber because Twaney took different roads and he made the decision to take this particular road probably at the last minute, but there's a sign of an obvious tip off by one of Twaney's inner circle. Well, I'd like to go back to, we're getting into very murky territory. I mean, Syria is being blamed for this. Perhaps Syria did the bombing, but other groups could have had motives and the opportunity to do the same thing. And this is going back into history a bit. This is from an article in the UK Guardian of September 27th, 2003, a little over 2 years ago. And it talks about a Syria assassination plot that was cooked up in 1957 between President Eisenhower and British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. This is what the Guardian article by Ben Fenton has to say. Nearly 50 years before the war in Iraq, Britain and America sought a secretive regime change in another Arab country they accused of spreading terror and threatening the West's oil supplies by planning the invasion of Syria and the assassination of leading figures. Newly discovered documents show how in 1957, Harold Macmillan and President Dwight Eisenhower approved a CIA MI6 plan to stage fake border incidents as an excuse for an invasion by Syria's pro-Western neighbors and then to eliminate the most influential triumvirate in Damascus. The plans, frighteningly frank in their discussion, were discovered in the private papers of Duncan Sandys, Mr. Macmillan's defense secretary, by Matthew Jones, a reader in international history at Royal Holloway, University of London. Although historians know that intelligence services had sought to topple the Syrian regime in the autumn of 1957, this is the first time any document has been found showing that the assassination of three leading figures was at the heart of the scheme. In the document drawn up by a top-secret and high-level working group that met in Washington in September 1957, Mr. Macmillan and President Eisenhower were left in no doubt about the need to assassinate the top men in Damascus. Part of the preferred plan reads, in order to facilitate the action of liberative forces, reduce the capabilities of the Syrian regime to organize and direct its military actions, to hold losses and destruction to a minimum, and to bring about desired results in the shortest possible time, a special effort should be made to eliminate certain key individuals. Their removal should be accomplished early in the course of the uprising and intervention and in the light of circumstances existing at the time. And one of the driving the call for action was the CIA's Middle East chief, Kermit Roosevelt. Now, Kermit Roosevelt was the man who, 4 years before, in 1953, orchestrated the coup that threw out the president of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, and put the Shah of Iran back on the throne. Getting back to the article in The Guardian, the report said that once a necessary degree of fear had been created, frontier incidents and border clashes would be staged to provide a pretext for Iraqi and Jordanian military interventions. Syria had to be made to appear as a sponsor of plots, sabotage, and violence directed against neighboring governments, the report says. CIA and SIS should use their capabilities in both the psychological and action fields to augment tension. That meant operations in Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon taking the form of sabotage, national conspiracies, and various strong-armed activities to be blamed on Damascus. So there we have a background on this. At last report, Detlev Meles has stepped down. The investigation is continuing under another UN person, a jurist from Belgium, I believe, and the investigation is continuing. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Canada continue to deport people to Syria, where they know that they face deportation. Now, this is a strange state of affairs. Here we are accusing Syria of plotting assassinations of government-leading enemies. At the same time, the U.S. and Canada are deporting people to Syria, where they will no doubt be tortured. So all I can say right now is that the evidence is very murky. There are a lot of facts that need to be cleared up. And to blame Syria and ignore these other possible sponsors of assassination, I think it's too soon to jump to those conclusions. Well, this is coming on the holiday, Christmas, Yuletide season. I'd like to make a few remarks. Earlier this morning on Ani and Melody's show, they played Dick Gawkins' song about Stand Up for Judas, which is a kind of a funny song in a way. But it's based on the Sunday school version of what Jesus was all about. And so Gawkins is sort of taking the opposite version of the Sunday school version. And a lot of the contradiction between Jesus and Judas was based on how do you fight the Roman Empire. Judas was a zealot and one of the Sicarii. Sicarii were sort of these dagger-wielding assassins who specialized in killing Roman soldiers. They were the so-called terrorists of their day. And Judas was a zealot. Now, whether that strategy worked, you have to look at history. Their struggle eventually was crushed. The Romans wiped out the zealots. They destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, and the Jews began their long diaspora. The strategy of Jesus was more like civil disobedience, and he was eventually executed by the Romans. So it's like the strategy of Judas did not work in ancient Palestine. You might say that it's working in Iraq right now. But it was disastrous for the Jews of Israel at that time of ancient Palestine. You know, they were forced out of there. They began their long diaspora. And, of course, now they claim their biblical right of return, which they deny to the Palestinians, which is one root of the turmoil today, along with Western imperialism, which is the new Rome. So having said that, we wish you a happy season, however you want to call it, and we will continue with KBOO's programming. Stay tuned for Pat McGuire and Boneheads and Bigots.
to. We could have turned oregano into marijuana, or sugar into cocaine, or vitamin pills into amphetamines. Or he could have just looked you in the eye, and you would instantly be automatically be tripping. He walked on water and swam on the land. He would tell these stories, and people would listen. If you were blind or lame, you just went up to, well, actually, if you were lame, Jesus would go up to you, and he would put his hands on you, and you would be healed. That's so cool. He could have played guitar better than Hendrix. He could have told the future. He could have baked the most delicious cake in the world. Jesus could have scored more goals than Wayne Gretzky. He could have danced better than Baryshnikov. Jesus could have been funnier than any comedian you could ever think of. He told people to eat his body and drink his blood. That's totally hardcore. But then some people got jealous of how cool he was, so they killed him. But then he rose from the dead. He rose from the dead, did a little dance, and went up to heaven. I mean, that is so cool. Jesus was way cool. No wonder there are so many Christians.